good.
And he only of the goodness of
depressed.
God. But eventually,
and
he built himself a small hut.
Hearing this message,
and
I was
put his meager possessions
in the same lines as Pastor Keith was.
But one day, after hunting for
every
some
now
food,
and again, he came back.
We need to get a break from.
His hut had gone up in flames.
You know, we're living in a sinful world that everything around us
to
is
the
crashing
sky
and burning.
He was absolutely
and we yet need to hear something really
all
nice.
All he had
as
been taken from him.
Frank calls
this
it
as well.
Pudding.
Everything.
So that's what
was
we're
this
having
really
tonight.
Necessary?
Is pudding.
But early the next day, a ship
we're all in
near the island
the habit of, and we're tempted to ask,
and when
where
he came
is
on
God?
Board, he said to the
particularly
crew,
when we're going
did
through
you
very
know
difficult
I was here?
Circumstances.
To which they replied,
we've just recently in our cell groups gone through
sometimes
the book of Job.
What is happening to us is simply
and we find
a
it difficult
signal.
To look at the
and
the
God
story
is
of Job
to
and
rescue
think,
us.
You
the
know,
choice is
did
ours.
This really happen?
Do we choose?
Is it possible
in those times
for this to have
to
happened to one person?
Or beautiful?
And we think, well, you know, that just doesn't make sense. Just doesn't make sense.
We find it a little incredulous that something like that could have happened to one man in the space of a day. But what I did with our particular cell group is I took it to the 1920s and I rewrote the story. And suddenly everyone began to realize, wait a minute, you know, that sounds just like us. And that is us. We go through difficult situations every day. Things come our way and things become difficult. And then we have a tendency to say, where is God? We have a tendency, like Job's wife, to say, curse God and die. Just walk on. Take a walk. Let's just leave this now. There's nothing like a story to bring the issues of life to the fore for us to understand how things actually happen. And suddenly, we can take familiar stories and make it our own. When that was not me. When Benjamin Franklin was the ambassador to France, he occasionally attended the Infidels Club. Now you're beginning to wonder, what did they do there? Well, they were a group of people that spent most of their time searching for and reading literary masterpieces. On one occasion, Franklin read from the Book of Ruth. He read this to the club. But he changed the names of the people in the story so that they wouldn't recognize the book. As he finished, everybody, without exception, said that had to be the best story they had ever heard in their lives. It was one of the most beautiful short stories they had ever heard. And where had he come across such a remarkable story? And it was with a great deal of glee that he told them that it came from the Bible. Very often, as I said, we can't identify with what is happening, what happened to the people in the Bible. If we look at the book of Ruth, we also begin to think, well, you know, that's not me. That's not us. How can we put ourselves into that particular story? But you know, our circumstances, we can benefit from looking at that particular story. But very often, and I was particularly thinking of this group of people, because the people that come in the evening are very familiar with the Word of God. Everybody knows the Word of God exceptionally well. I don't have to ask anyone here whether they've read the Book of Ruth, because everyone will say yes. Everyone knows the story exceptionally well. And what happens when we know something very well? When we get to that part of the Bible in our reading, we think, oh, well, this is the yummy part. I'll just quickly read through it. This is lovely. But we forget that there is something in there that we should put in our circumstances. God wrote it for a specific reason. There are nuances in the book that we miss because we don't read it as it was intended to be read. And as you know, I love telling a story. So tonight I'm not going to preach, I'm going to tell you a story. Just like Benjamin Franklin did. But I'm changing the names. In fact, I'm using the names that God had given them. The names that the book of Ruth actually means. And while I'm going through it, begin to think of it as, how does this apply to my life? And we will begin to see that it actually does apply. You see, our story begins around the time that all that good stuff began to take place in the book of Judges. When God was judging the people for the things that they had done. So basically, mostly judging was going on. And in Judges, at the time of Judges, we meet this nice Jewish family who lived in the house of bread in worship. The guy's name was My God is King. And his wife's name was Beautiful Grace. And they had two sons, sickly and failing. You see, they were the perfect nuclear family, almost with a picket fence. But My God and King had other ideas. You see, famine had hit the house of bread in worship because sin had crept in. And when there is sin, there's no house, there is no bread in the house because there's no worship. So they decided to take a little wander over to a land called Incest, because they would find bread there. So they settled in and got acquainted with the locals. In fact, they got very acquainted with the locals because the two sons married two local girls. Stubbornness and friendship. Later, My God is King died because they were in incest. And 10 years down the line, sickly and failing died too. But they didn't leave any children behind, which was a huge downer for Beautiful Grace, because she didn't even have any grandkids to spoil. And if she did, she wouldn't have been so miserable. But since the famine in the house of bread had also come to an end around this time, Beautiful Grace decided to make her way back to worship. And her daughters-in-law, Stubbornness and Friendship, packed up their bags and decided to go with her. But Beautiful Grace begged them not to follow her because she couldn't provide for them. They lived in a time where women could not provide for themselves. They needed men to earn the money. And she told them to go back to their mothers' houses. Soon they would find really nice husbands to take care of them. Maybe they'd even get to star in their own reality show called Real Housewives of Incest. Now, by this time, everyone was crying, even Lulu. Beautiful Grace kissed the girls and wished them well, but they refused to turn back. They begged to go with her to worship. But Beautiful Grace wouldn't give up, and she urged them to go back to their mothers. Eventually, she lays it all down on the line, and she says, you know, it's no use going with me because I'm never going to have more sons. And even if I did, are you going to wait around till they were adults to marry them? And besides, by that time, you'll be too old to have children. So this eventually gets through to Stubbornness, and she thinks, well, you know, it's not a bad idea to go back to my mother's house. And mentally, she starts preparing her next wedding in her head. So peace out, Stubbornness. But Friendship isn't giving up. She pledges to follow beautiful grace wherever she goes in a lovely bit of poetry. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. She must have been some mother-in-law. I'd like to be that kind of mother-in-law, but I know that sometimes my daughters-in-law give me a little bit of a squiff look. It happens. But back in worship, beautiful grace, arrival after 10 years, that's going to be big news. And the gossip mill begins, and it starts churning instantly. Beautiful grace is back in town. But beautiful grace warns him, don't call me that anymore. Don't address me as beautiful grace. Call me bitter. Call me bitterness. Because God has really dealt me a nasty hand in life. You see, the famine is clearly last decade's news. Because the barley harvest is about to begin in the house of bread. So everyone's miserable because they don't have a husband. And friendship tells beautiful grace she's going to the barley fields to glean in the lands. That's what poor people did. They picked up the scraps in the corners of the fields. Think of it as dustbin day. When you put out your dustbin and the guys come around and they scratch in your bins, same thing. That's what she went to do. And it just so happens that friendship goes and gleans in the field of a close relative called Redeemer. He has a lovely name, and in my mind, he's handsome too. So coincidence of coincidence, she just happens to pick the part of the field that Redeemer owns. So what's the chances? And he just happens by at that moment, and he says to his laborers, who's that girl? I'm thinking she couldn't have been a bad looker, because he noticed her immediately. There had to have been a lot of poor people around at that time, gleaning in the fields, and he noticed her. And the servants explain that she's beautiful Grace's daughter-in-law. And he's saying, well, just give her a little bit extra because she's obviously good people. Redeemer tells his workers she's allowed to take some of the non-charity grain. And that evening, Friendship gets home and she tells beautiful Grace all that has happened. And her mind begins to work. And she begins to hatch a plan for Friendship to snag Redeemer. And she tells her daughter-in-law to pretty herself up, go and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes. And then go to Redeemer when he's sleeping on the threshing floor. And when he's lying down, she must lie at his feet. Now, well, you know, in today's terms, we think, well, that's a little bit, yeah, no. But apparently it was quite sexy back then. Just saying. Friendship agrees and heads out to lie with Redeemer. Just so you know, in the biblical sense. It's quite comfy, but around midnight, Redeemer wakes up and he finds her there and he says, what? And she identifies herself and she explains that he's her next of kin. You family, you know, Redeemer. And he's actually pretty psyched about this idea. And he says, you know, you're a super loyal lady. You know, you haven't gone to town and looked for a young guy. He knows she's a worthy woman. In other words, friendship's actually quite a catch. So Redeemer tells her that there's another relative that is even closer, but he would speak to him in the morning. And that's what he does very first thing the following morning. But before she leaves, he gives her a bunch of barley. How romantic is that? Better than roses, any day. And she's, well, sort of engaged.
the next of kin at the gate the following morning, and the guy says, yes, you know what, I'm pretty into real estate. I think I'll go for it. And he explains to the guy, actually, you know, she comes with a mother-in-law and the daughter, which you have to marry, and then you have to have a child with her, but it's not going to be your child, it's going to be her dead, sickly husband's child, because the field has to come back to him. And he says, you know what, I don't really like this deal. You go for it. And he's cool with that. So to seal the deal, the guy takes off his sandal. I mean, why waste paper? Just murdering another tree. And Redeemer decides he will step in and gets the land and the girl. And the elders all nod in agreement. And it's cool with him. It's witnessed by 10 people, so it's done. They offer their blessings for the newlyweds and wish them well. And friendship and Redeemer tie the knot. And pretty soon, she's going to have a son. And beautiful Grace is thrilled to discover that God, in the house of bread, in worship, has not deserted her. He hasn't given up on her. Doesn't matter how far she's strayed into incest or anything else, he's still pretty much for her. He's given her a grandson and a daughter-in-law, whom the other women in the town say that she's actually better than 7 sons. That's pretty high praise. So when the child is born, they name him Servant. And Servant eventually becomes the father of Jehovah Exists, who eventually became the father of the beloved son. The end. You know, the problems of life don't come neatly packed, pre-packed, like in strips of shrink-wrapped paper, plastic paper, pre-packaged, catcheled and labeled health, wealth, happiness. Like beautiful Grace, we need to take our problems to God in worship. He leaves nothing just out there to sort itself out. His timing leaves nothing to be desired. He's almost is always on time. He's never late. To us, it seems like he is. It seems like he's coming in at the 11th hour to save us from our predicament. But let me illustrate it like this. I heard a scientist explain the mystery of black holes in the universe. They are stars which have collapsed and don't emit light. And he likened it to the dance floor, pretty much like that song we sang at the beginning. When the ladies are all dressed in white and the men are all dressed in black. And if the lights are turned out, you can see the white ladies. And you know the men are there because of the way they are moving. You see, life's problems are pretty much like that. In the dark times of life, it seems like the lights have been turned off. And we can only see part of what is taking place. Yet, our faith in God leaves us believing that he is controlling every movement that is taking place. There's things happening in the spiritual realm right now that we cannot see. But God is in control. And one day the lights will be turned on and we will be able to understand why it is we are going through the things that we are going through. In times of crisis, the world offers solutions. They look good. They smell good. They even taste good. But it's not for you, and it's not for me, if it's out of God's will. Out of God's will, we become targets for Satan. He wants everything you have. He wants those packages, health, wealth, and happiness. He doesn't want you.
It simply wants to destroy you. The whole world is suffering. We are a needy people. We need God. And sometimes it looks undeserved. And it's meaningless. No illness is deserved. No hard time is deserved. And we think that what we are going through is meaningless. Why is this happening to me? Why is this necessary? Why me, God? But God's word gives us the assurance. He is there for his people. He sees you. He sees every one of us. He sees what we're going through. He knows us. Everything that's going on in our lives. He knows when we are suffering. He knows when we're going through a hard time. He knows when we are struggling with the question, why me, God? Where are you in this difficult situation? It doesn't mean that he's going to intervene in this problem to prevent it from happening. But he is merciful. He loves us and he cares for us. And he provides beautiful grace. He is the Almighty. And just in the, as I've read the story to you, I've told the story to you about Ruth tonight, using the name, the meaning of their names. God has a name for you. Every one of us have a name that he has given us. And every one of those names have a very special meaning. And it describes everything that we have gone through. And it describes how we have held on to him and we have not let go in our times of trouble, in our times of struggle. We don't know what those names are now, but we will one day. We will know the name that God has for us. But I can assure you, it's beautiful because he gives us beautiful grace. Even when we are completely unaware of what is happening, or why something is happening, God is guiding us. He's working everything together for our good and for his ultimate glory, even if we can't see it right now. Our responsibility is to surrender to his sovereignty. The trial of our faith should make us better. Not bitter. It should make us beautiful, not bitter.